please do not hurt me. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. And Father Sky says, now take good care of me. Please do not hurt me. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. Creatures say, take good care of us. Please do not hurt us. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. And we are here to be ourselves, to be with one another, surroundings, to be, and we are here to take care of ourselves, to take care of one another, to take care of our surroundings, Nastan anila nijane go shabothya, nijane go shabothya. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh. Hey, 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 oh. Hey, oh, hey, oh, hey, oh.
Greetings. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat-Kitishi Native American Center. We are broadcasting on RFPI, Radio for Peace International, Global Community Radio. Akwe, welcome. This is your host, Ones Pritzker. Wolf Mountain Radio focuses on protecting Mother Earth, defending Native lands and Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices presents the situations facing Native peoples throughout the world with Native news, interviews, music, commentaries, and investigative reports. This program serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and the traditional cultural lifeways of Indigenous peoples throughout the world. Please listen now to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Ho, Kanawantakwasin, to all of our relations.
Thank you.
Native American musician Kevin Locke off his CD, Midnight Strongheart. The name of that song was Omimi, which is the Anishinaabe word for dove, the bird who represents peace. Ashkwe, greetings and hello, everyone. Welcome to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yad Kiddushi Native Center. We began today's program with that song, Omimi, in honor of my guest here in the studio, Mr. Eugene Purnell. Eugene is a person of peace. He is also a longtime civil rights activist who grew up in the racially segregated South. I am proud to say that Eugene and I have been friends for many years. We first met over a decade ago when a number of us in Southwest Florida came together to form a human rights council in order to deal with many racial and social injustices that unfortunately still occur here in Florida and throughout the country. Eugene is an African-American brother who, although experienced racism and prejudice growing up, has risen above this to become a world citizen, concerned for the rights of all peoples. Eugene comes from Memphis, Tennessee, on the banks of the Mississippi River. His life experience has been like the blues music he listens to. He has picked cotton and field crops, worked on the docks as a longshoreman, been a shrimp fisherman, worked construction, and is a trained mechanic. Throughout all this, Eugene has self-studied many world religions. His philosophy and worldview is very enlightening. Today's broadcast is program two of my interview with Mr. Purnell. In program one, Eugene had just spoken about his participation in the Civil Rights March led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in support of the Memphis, Tennessee Garbage Men Workers Fight for Justice. Our program was nearing the end of our broadcast time when Eugene talked about hearing the tragic news that Dr. King had been shot to death. I want to ask you, sir, to please continue your comments about your experience and feelings after I replay the sentence you describe hearing reporter Walter Cronkite's announcement.
All of a sudden, the newscast came on. I broke into the middle of a program. The TV was on there. And it was Walter Cronkite. And he said that we've just got breaking news that Dr. King has just been assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And so we were shocked. We were all shocked. I could not really understand the immensity of it. I remember maybe 5 seconds later or maybe a minute or two later, they came back and said that there was a white Mustang convertible that the police suspect the assassin was in. I started thinking because I had just left that area. I had just left 3rd Street, 2nd Street, you know, the end of 2nd Street, maybe from where the march came from Beale in Maine. The end of 2nd is approximately 10 or 12 blocks. The Lorraine Motel, where they were staying, faced the west, and this rooming house was across the street where they say that James Earl Ray was, and he shot across the street to the balcony. At the end of 2nd, come down, you hit Crump Boulevard. Crump Boulevard, heading east, becomes Lamar, and it goes on out for 20, 30 miles. I mean, it, you know, it becomes a highway and blah, blah, you know, they change the names. The same road. And this white Mustang convertible made it from downtown straight out, all the way out Lamar. And there was nothing to stop it. Not a white Mustang convertible. And nobody stopped it. There was no stop for this car, which began to, you know, everybody, contrary to what people think, the people of Memphis know what happened, and they're not ignorant. The white Mustang convertible made it out, and during the time of the chase that was supposed to be on, I remember getting up from my girlfriend's house. I said that I want to go out on the corner and see what everybody's doing, what everybody's saying. So I jumped in my little car and went down to the pool room. Pool room was packed, and by that time everybody knew, the conversation going everywhere. About maybe 20 minutes later, you could feel the building rumble and the floor rumbling. So we went outside, and as we looked, there were personnel carriers, military personnel carriers, I guess National Guard or whatever, coming down Chelsea. This is out in North Memphis. The personnel carriers, some went by. One pulled in the lot. They vacated the lot because the curfew was going to be on. I remember they announced it over the TV, Walter Cronkite's breaking the story. They announced that there was going to be a curfew. I mean, this was quickly. So by the time the personnel carriers came, we had heard in the pool room that there was rioting breaking out in East Memphis. So, you know, we had to leave and get out. That's when I went home. It deeply affected me. I can't forget it. It was when I realized, truly realized, how repressive this place really can be. Of course, thank God, I had my epiphany, my spiritual transition, fortunately for me, because that I was even more conscious of the racial injustice in this country behind Dr. King's death. The urban removal that happened, which was the Great Society, it was supposed to be urban renewal, but it was really urban removal. And I later found out that it had happened all over America. There were areas, I mean, especially in the South, in the Southwest, previous to the Civil Rights Movement. This is a very important point for you young people and people everywhere in the world to understand about Memphis and about America. Prior to the Civil Rights Movement, there had never been a movement like this since after the Emancipation. The repressive means after emancipation and the fact that blacks and people of color and Indians had risen to high status right behind slavery. 30 years later, there were black politicians, senators, there were black businessmen, schools were being opened, everything. People who are left to be free as God gave us. We can succeed. Everybody. Every human being has this potential. But at that time, this was a threat to certain people in the South. Of course, this was the first Reconstruction. My insight into this is very important to me, of course, and of course I cherish this opportunity that I'm having now. What happened as a sort of Reconstruction? You know, the gains of the Civil Rights Movement, the march, the opening up of the neighborhoods, the redlining laws that were repealed, all of these good things were on the books. But at the same time, I was looking and I saw where prior to Dr. King's assassination in Memphis, Tennessee, we had one officer riding in a police car. The police system of today, if you look around you today, what you see is two officers. But this is the way it was in prior to the late 60s.
Well, in
Memphis, Tennessee, prior, it was just one officer. And the black officers, they can only work in black communities. There was one or two black detectives for the whole city. The rest of the black officers were, as I said, confined to the black areas. The threat that we posed as a people was not considered so great until after the Civil Rights Movement happened. Now, we all know today that the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s had whites. They were there. They had all kinds of people in the Civil Rights Movement. To me, the philosophical question is, why does a good pursuit bring this kind of reaction? All we wanted to do was get the right to vote, the right to live where we wanted to live, the right to education, and that's all. To be treated as human beings, the Jim Crow laws are throughout, no white this and black that, none of that. So the books changed, the laws changed, but the repression began anew in another form. I'll never forget it. That was, you know, they would say, well, oh, you know, they would talk about how crime was going up and how burglaries were happening everywhere. And they scared all of the women My grandmother never, nobody ever broke in the house. Never. And my grandmother wanted burglar bars because she's listening to this psychological tyranny that we're experiencing. I have not seen it stop yet. I've watched it from 1969 to now. The result of the civil rights movement in Memphis was an eradication under urban removal, which they call urban renewal, the Great Society. But under urban removal, I watched the eradication of all of the neighborhoods. To me, it seems as if they were saying, well, we'll change the redlining laws, and we'll make sure that redlining is not practiced, and you can move anywhere you want to move. But, of course, you know, that was a subterfuge, too, in a lot of ways. But the people who were at the top echelon of black society in this little closed, segregated society that we had, all of those people left. Over the years, I would say 60, 70, 80% of the people left. The other 20, 30% died off. And we have what you have today. And the people want to blame the people who live in these areas now for lack of this, lack of education, lack of common sense, lack of, they don't even know how to take care of themselves. And all of these prejudicial negatives that they lay on the people. Just look at it. What would you do if all your role models were gone? What would you do? At that point, I began to really see, I became very suspicious of the ways that things were done because, you know, we were all in this little segregated portion of town. But in that segregated portion of town, we had everything. So I was a small child. And I have to say this. There were nothing but, they didn't have any black bus drivers. There were white bus drivers when I was a kid. I do remember, you know, having to sit at the back of the bus, of course, when I was older. But I remember when I was eight and nine years old, I used to ride the bus. And my mother worked a lot. And I would get a chance to go visit my grandmother in South Memphis. So I rode the bus across town. And sometimes I wouldn't want to leave North Memphis because I'm playing with my friends. So I would leave just about dark. Fortunately, at the other end, across Memphis, I would get off. And I only had to walk across Parkway and down College Street, down the hill a little bit. And I'm at my grandmother's house. And they knew me, and they trusted everything. That's another thing. In the community, there was a lot of trust, a lot of trust. The elders saw you, they knew you, and if you messed up, boy, you had to account for it with a lot of people, not just your parents. I remember as a kid, 8, 9 years old, being on the bus, riding the four walker, going to South Memphis. And I remember when we got to the black neighborhood, the bus driver, because I had a habit of going to sleep, I'd just drop off. You know, I was a little kid, you know, I'm tired, so I'd go to sleep. The bus driver, he got used to me. He knew that, he knew what I was doing. He knew where I was going. When we got to the black neighborhood, I would sit behind him. I'd go right up and sit behind the driver. Then he'd shake me, hey, get off, and I'd go. So this was South Memphis, and I just wanted to put that out there because people must know that there is a reason why the ghettos, what we call ghettos today, which used to be good neighborhoods, community neighborhoods, where they had everything. I mean, they had doctors, teachers, lawyers, insurance people, bankers, gambling houses, baseball park. We had Martin Stadium, and the Negro League used to come through. It would be packed. So all of this that we used to have was gone under urban removal, under so-called renewal. So it was just the reverse. So all of the gains seem to mean that there is a repression coming afterwards. You know, the books might change, the laws change, the words change, but the action becomes even more repressive because people are getting close to uniting and destroying the old order. But this old order will be destroyed. If you're watching what's going on now in the world, 2006, what we're doing in Iraq, Lord have mercy. What goes around comes around.
Play a tune here that's about wrestling with white skin privilege in a structurally racist society where those of us who are marked as white shine with our privilege as we walk down the street. No matter how radical we are, we still have to face up to the fact that we benefit from this system of oppression and that our silence is complicity.
It's a tool that was made by a nation to justify slavery and colonization. Divide up the world into an us and a them, the primitive animal savage and the civilized human. Race is a story we're told, embedded deep in the brain. They call it natural order, but it's socially ingrained. Systematic exploitation by division of the people into some were made as slaves to serve but once created equal. First thing they conquer is their own people's minds. The colonizer's the first one to be colonized. We're born with pale skin and they tell us we're white. Blind, some will live in darkness and this child will walk in light. What color is God in our pictures? And what is the color of sin? If two came to your door, one pale, one dark-skinned, who'd be the first one that you would let in? Demands we undo what's been done. Name our history, find the courage to rise. Shout it out loud with bold, angry cries. No more white lies. On earth, so they say. Where did this wealth come from? So the labor of slaves, all those who suffered and toiled and died, feeding the hunger of rich white man's pride. Who works in our orchards? Who picks our fine crops? Who sweats in our sweatshops? Who pushes the mops? Who rots in our prisons for the crime of their skin? Who dies in our wars so that others can win? Here before us, and who stole their land, and who are the heroes of Custer's last stand? Who wrote the history books? Who makes the rules? And who mines the ore for the master's own tools? Shame hangs his head, guilt tries to run. Publicity demands we undo what's been done. Name our history, find the courage to rise. Shout it out loud with bold, angry cries. No more white lies. Well, I am not racist, many white folks have said, but racism's not just a thought in your head. It's the privilege we wield when we walk down the street and don't have to fear each white cop that we meet. The power we're handed from the moment of birth, when we're told our pale skin is our measure of worth. Colorblind is a code word for the problem's not mine, cause white folks got the privilege to say everything's fine. It's in the history of our families, the stories that we bear. It's in the small subtle perks along the way that got us there. It's in all the shit we never went through, all the pain we never felt. It's in the stacked deck of cards and the hand we were dealt. Irish or Italian or Basque, call up your grandma if you can and just ask. We traded history for power, tradition for slaves, buried our pride with the bodies in the unmarked graves. Shame hangs his head, guilt tries to run. Complicity demands we undo what's been done. Name our history, find the courage to rise. Shout it out loud with bold, angry cries. No more white lies. So who's really to blame, it's not easy to say. And of course those in power want to keep it that way. This trouble runs deep to the core of our souls. We were formed by the power that our ancestors stole. Is it the structure of the person keeps racism alive? Well, it's both, and they're nourished by the great white lie. We gotta struggle on the inside, gotta struggle on the out. Cause struggling together is what solidarity is about. Demands we undo what's been done. Name our history, find courage to rise. Shout it out loud with bold, angry cries. No more white lies. No more white lies. No more white lies. No more white lies.
Music from singer-songwriters Ethan Miller and Kate Boberman off their Riot Folk CD. The name of that song was White Lies. You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. This is your host, Ones. My guest today is Mr. Eugene Purnell, a longtime friend of mine and civil rights activist. Eugene, thank you very much for sharing your experience about being in Memphis during the time Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered. This is very important history for everyone to hear. It is very personal to me, since I've had the honor to meet Coretta Scott King several times over the years when I was in Atlanta involved with the Southern Organizing Committee's Environmental Justice Task Force. This past summer, I had the privilege to meet a personal friend and colleague of Dr. King, civil rights activist Bernard Lafayette. Dr. Lafayette is director of the Center for Nonviolence and Peace Studies at the University of Rhode Island. He is a noted scholar on nonviolent social change. Many know Dr. Lafayette as one of the organizers and leaders of the historic Civil Rights March on Washington. I met Dr. Lafayette when I had the honor to be a guest speaker with him at the SGI Buddhist International FNCC's Center's 10th anniversary event entitled Celebrating a Global Culture of Peace. There was a wonderful exhibit entitled Victory Over Violence, Gandhi, King, and Ikeda, A Legacy of Building Peace. During my conversation with Dr. Lafayette, he spoke about the concern many of us have with regard to the U.S. official version of the assassination of Dr. King at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. I know the King family themselves have unanswered questions about the murder. One issue still in question is whether or not James Earl Ray actually was the shooter. Do you, Eugene, have any thoughts on this subject?
Yes. If you go back to what I was saying about the circumstances after he was shot on the balcony and the white Mustang convertible, this white Mustang convertible made it, I mean, it had to go through the heart of the city. It came from the downtown area. If you had gone two blocks the other way, you'd be in the Mississippi River. So they were at the end of the line on 2nd Street. If you go down Crump to Lamar and go out East Memphis, straight out, the same. He didn't have to make a turn. All he had to do was, well, he turned from the rooming house or wherever, you know, it originated. This is through maybe 25, 30, 40, 50 traffic lights. This is 4, 6, 8 lanes of traffic. This guy had to get through all of this in a white Mustang convertible. How could that be? In my mind, I couldn't figure it out. How can he make it this far? The mayor at that time was Mayor Henry Loeb. In my opinion, it was a situation where people in authority knew what was going down. I've always felt this way. I feel this way today. There was no sense or order to how he could get to England and be arrested in an airport in England. How could he get that far? As big as Memphis is, I was very angry. I remember being very angry. Mr. Loeb, Henry Loeb, immediately left office, went to a farm he had in Arkansas. So he moved out of the state of Tennessee. which, of course, he didn't have to go very far. The Mississippi River was right there. You cross the river, you're in Arkansas. For me to believe that James Earl Ray had no accomplices or that he was the lone assassin, gunman, I can't believe it. I've never been able to believe that this guy made it by himself. And I'm going to say, put a little quirk in here. One thing, you know, prisoners have a lot of knowledge. And, of course, he lived a long, long time for some reason. Of course, I mean, in the beginning, I remember hearing about him, you know, he had to be protected because he was going to be assassinated in prison. He was at, if I remember correctly, Brushy Mountain State Prison. But he wasn't. I mean, this man died, you know, natural death, right? So the other aspects of the case have never been more important to me than the fact that if there was a willingness to catch the assassin of Dr. King, that white Mustang convertible would not have gotten 25, 30 miles down a single street. There's no way it could have been done. So without the complicity of the authorities, to this day I believe that.
Eugene, listening to you today provides me time to reflect on the serious issues of racism and xenophobia in America, which even now in the 21st century is still a virulent disease. It is very important for our worldwide audience to hear about this, as racial discrimination is still a daily reality for many people of color. Racism is not just a thing of the past. White supremacy is in fact on the rise in America and in other parts of the world, such as in Europe. Neo-Nazi groups and the Ku Klux Klan are now much more organized and even well-financed. Several white supremacy groups, such as PAR and the Interstate Congress for Equal Rights and Responsibility, specifically target their hatred towards Native American communities and fight against Native rights. Radio for Peace International, which Wolf Mountain Radio is proud to be a member of RFPI's International Board of Advisors, has been exposing hate radio for many years, which can be heard across the airwaves. Wolf Mountain Radio has also done a number of programs on this topic. Studies by such respected organizations as the Southern Poverty Law Center, NAACP, the National Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights, and the National Congress of American Indians document the increase of violent racial crimes against people of color, despite the lack of action on the part of the so-called U.S. Justice Department. I remember growing up as a Native youth when racial violence against American Indians was very common. Across Indian country, many reservations, such as my own, were under assault by white people who fought against Native fishing rights. I remember when our fishing boats and nets were destroyed by non-Indians. I remember growing up when American Indians were not welcomed in white-owned restaurants and businesses. Even today, many of us still fight for protecting sacred sites such as sacred Matopaha, Bear Butte, against the biker bar resort being planned in the Black Hills. What about we American Indians having to constantly fight for enforcement of the Native American Indian Religious Freedom Act, or NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection Repatriation Act? What about all the negative anti-Indian stereotypes seen in the national media, or the racist names of sports teams, such as the Washington Redskins? What about the long list of insulting names of commercial products, such as Crazy Horse Beer or the video game Custer's Last Revenge? Why is it all right and acceptable to still denigrate indigenous peoples? The public got rid of Aunt Jemima and the Little Black Sambo. When will racist images of anti-Indians be done away with? I, like you, Eugene, have many white friends, which I appreciate the support for racial justice. I, too, have over the years changed my attitude of dislike towards white America. I try not to judge people on the color of their skin or on their cultural heritage. I, too, believe in peace and respect for all peoples. I am a great advocate for multicultural knowledge and learning from one another. Yeah.
season ended. During a normal working day, I answered many questions from non-Indians concerning Indians. The questions vary, and in some cases, poorly stated, but usually add up to one question. What is an Indian? They say he is a person who doesn't work, but gets a monthly check from the government. Others say that he is lazy. Still others say he's a man who got a raw deal from the government. Therefore, he deserves what he can get from the government. Also others say that he is a drunkard, will never amount to anything. So therefore, the government should terminate him and let him make his own way in the white man's society. Myself, I do not see an Indian in the same light as any of these people. I see the Indian as a group of people, all different in their ways, but held together by a common bond called culture. I see the Indian as a group who fought for what was rightfully theirs and branded as savages. I see the Indians as a group who fought courageously against overwhelming odds and after giving in and signing a peace treaty, lived to see the treaties broken one by one. I see the Indians as an individual who, when their country was in danger, went to the front voluntarily and gave their last full measure of devotion, not only in the Civil War, but World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, and Vietnam. I see the Indian as a group of people who are proud, and rightfully so, because they possess the secrets of life the white man has never discovered. I see the Indians as a group of people because even in their broken English, they will tell you how important it is to gain an education in this modern world. I see the Indians as people who, when they cross the culture barrier into the dominant society, become the best in their chosen profession, whether it be law, medicine, politics, trader, athletes, or fighting for freedom. And when I think of the Indian in this light, I think of the question, what is an Indian? My chest suddenly expands, and I think, I am an Indian.
You are listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yat Kitichi Native Center. Yat Kitichi Native Center defends Mother Earth and the cultural lifeways of indigenous peoples throughout the world. Yat Kitichi Native Center is an intertribal culture and arts, environmental protection, social justice, and news media organization. Yat Kitichi Native Center portrays Native peoples and their worldviews in a more accurate and in-depth depiction of both our ancestral and contemporary cultures. Yat Kitichi Native Center serves to educate by providing a deeper understanding of our diverse cultures, arts, values, histories, and contemporary situations. Yat Kitichi tries to honor traditional ways by instilling an appreciation and respect for Mother Earth and tribal peoples throughout the world. Yat Kitichi Native Center educates the public on important issues facing indigenous communities. We work in support of intertribal, cultural, environmental, and social justice issues by networking with other organizations and events which share our concerns. Yatkidichi Native Center serves as a focal point for Native news and information. We maintain a documentary library for networking with the Native and international press. Yatkidichi Native Center's Speakers Bureau provides spokespersons for school programs, conference speakers, and community presentations. Yatkidichi Native Center is experienced in planning, promoting Native forums, symposiums, powwows, and cultural events. Yatkidichi's Mishkwinataki Environment Program protects Mother Earth through conservation and restoration projects. Yatkidichi's Environmental Education Program focuses on curriculum development, teacher training, and nature field trips. We are members of the professional organization, the North American Association of Environmental Education. Yatkidichi's Kinonwatakwisi Native Arts creates quality handcrafted traditional and contemporary fine arts. Please request our catalog of custom flutes, pottery, beaded necklaces, bracelets, earrings, leather pouches, hat bands, and chokers with bone. Yatkidichi Native Center's Wolf Mountain Radio Program, Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, honors Native American and Indigenous peoples throughout the world by being a voice for our ancestors, contemporary, and future generations. Please write us for our catalog of audio tapes available for purchase. Native peoples throughout the world are concerned for the well-being of Sacred Mother Earth, tribal sovereignty, and respect for cultural lifeways. If you appreciate hearing Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices, we ask you, our listeners, to help financially support our program to stay on the air. Wolf Mountain Radio is an all-volunteer production. Any financial contribution to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices will be greatly appreciated. We thank you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth Indigenous Voices. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Please feel free to contact us about our consulting services, or if you or your organization is interested in hosting a speaker or educational forum. To contact Yatkidichi Native Center, write to Yatkidichi Native Center, 1731 16th Avenue Northeast, Naples, Florida, 34120, USA. Yatkidichi Native Center sincerely thanks you. Aho, Kinawatakwisin, to all of our relations.
The music you heard prior to our Yatkidichi Native Center program identification was from Mescalero Inde Apache singer A. Paul Ortega from his Canyon Records CD, Two Worlds, Three Worlds. The name of that classic song was What is an Indian? Well, dear friends, we are nearing the end of our broadcast time together for this edition of Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. I want to again sincerely thank my friend Eugene Purnell for sharing his heart with us on Wolf Mountain Native Radio. I want to thank all of our worldwide audience for listening to Wolf Mountain Radio and for the nice comments you send us about our program. Listeners can also email us at yatkidichi@earthlink.net. Once again, our email is yatkidichie@earthlink.net. Listeners can also learn more about Yatkidichi Native Center by visiting our website, www.yatkidichi.org. Yatkidichi Native Center's website is www.yatkidichie.org. We shall conclude today's broadcast with two songs. First, we will hear an honor song to the Underground Railroad heroine Harriet Tubman from the All People Singers. We will end with Lakota Thunder's traditional drum honoring song to our Indigenous people's cultural spiritual lifeways entitled Way of Life, the title track to their Makoshe music CD. This is your host and producer, Ones Pritzker. Thank you for listening to Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices. Aho, Kinawantakwisin, to all of our relations.
Come on up.
You are listening to Wolf Mountain Radio's Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, a production of the Yatkidishi Native Center. Yatkidishi's Wolf Mountain Radio is an independent Indigenous media service. Our award-winning program, Honoring Mother Earth, Indigenous Voices, serves to protect sacred Mother Earth and defend the traditional cultural lifeways of Native peoples around the world. Wolf Mountain Radio presents the situations facing Native lands and tribal communities with news, interviews, commentaries, music, and investigative reports. Estás escuchando el programa de radio Wolf Mountain, honrando a la Tierra Madre y voces indígenas, una producción del Centro Nativo Yatkidishi. La radio Wolf Mountain de Yatkidishi es un servicio de medios independientes indígena. Nuestro programa, honrando a la Tierra Madre y voces indígenas, sirve para proteger la Tierra Madre Sagrada y defender las culturas tradicionales de gente nativa en todo el mundo. La radio Wolf Mountain presenta las situaciones enfrentadas por tierras nativas y comunidades indígenas con noticias, entrevistas, comentarios, música y reportes investigativos.